Faculty of Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. Dr. Carl Truman is the professor of historical theology and church history and also recently appointed as a provost of the seminary. He is, as you will quickly discover, not of American vintage, but rather is an Englishman who brings a unique perspective to his ministry in our country and to our country. He has degrees from no less an institution than the University of Cambridge, specifically St. Catherine's College, and a PhD from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. He has taught previous to coming to America at the University of Nottingham in England and then at Aberdeen. He has been on the faculty for a little over a decade at Westminster, and during his time there has been inspired to write prolifically and has, among his many articles and books, published the following: Republicrat, Confessions of a Liberal Conservative. Wow, doesn't that catch your interest? Minority Report, Unpopular Thoughts on Everything. The Wages of Spin, Critical Writings on Evangelicalism. Histories and Fallacies and Reformation Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. From what I have read of Dr. Truman's writings and from hearing him, I am thrilled to be able to inform you that you're going to hear a man of humor and of unique insight, a man who can look at things in a different way than most people who get locked into their boxes, a man of profoundly rooted biblical and reformed faith, who is also of great insight and great awareness of the world in which we live. Frankly, that's what all of we preachers of the gospel ought to aspire to be, rooted both in scripture and in a true, deep understanding of the modern world and its needs. And he is able to bring to us insights from the past, as well as making history come alive as few can do, by making it contemporary, relevant, and helping us to see the connections and the ways in which the truths found and lived in the past can be fresh and relevant to us today. So, without any further words, would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Carl Truman?
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you tonight. When you heard me shout a few minutes ago, "It's all junk," I wasn't referring to anybody here. I was actually checking my email and didn't realize that my microphone was switched on at the time. My email was all junk today. I was simply expressing exasperation at it. The brief I've been given tonight is to talk about John Knox. And I'm aware that you already had a couple of lectures on the Reformation before my arrival. And next week, my friend, and not quite a countryman, he's actually a Welshman, but my good friend Derek Thomas will be here to speak about the Puritans. My brief is to speak about John Knox. John Knox is an interesting figure within the Reformation because he arrives in what we call the second generation of reformers. He was born, as with so many of these early modern figures, we're not exactly sure when he was born, but it was sometime between 1505 and 1515 in Scotland. And therefore, he was, by the time he arrived at adulthood, the Reformation in Europe had already been going for over a decade. My friend Bill Edgar no doubt filled you in on the background to Martin Luther a few weeks ago. Luther, of course, launches his Reformation process in 1517, and things develop very rapidly over the next 3 or 4 years to the point where he's excommunicated in 1520, and in 1521 is effectively made an outlaw within the empire. So from 1521 onwards, the breach within the church is permanent. It cannot be crossed or healed. Then, of course, in 1529, Luther falls out badly with Huldrych Zwingli, the reformer of Zurich, and Protestantism itself splits between the Reformed and Lutheran factions within Protestantism. Well, John Knox will end up very much in the Reformed faction of Protestantism. He will also have a different understanding of Reformation to Martin Luther. Not that they disagreed on many doctrines. They both, Luther and Knox, would have firmly agreed on something like justification by grace through faith. But their understanding of the times was different. And it's significant that we grasp this right at the start in order to make sense of Knox's life. For Martin Luther, Luther really thought that he was living at the end of time. He thought that history was about to come to an end, that Christ was about to return, and that what he was engaged in was a recovery of the gospel. A gospel that had been buried through bad and wrong teaching for hundreds of years. And therefore Luther's understanding of himself was as something of an apocalyptic figure. He'd arrived at the very end of time, and it was his job to preach the gospel, and the gospel would go forward with great power, sweep all before it, and usher in the second coming of Christ. It's one of the reasons why Luther becomes so ferociously opposed to the Jews in the late 1530s and 1540s. He's not anti-Semitic in the modern sense of the word. He would have had no concept of race as we think of race today. But for Luther, the second coming of Christ was to be preceded by mass conversion of the Jews. And because the Jews would not convert, he felt they were hindering the return of Christ and spoiling the Reformation. For Martin Luther, for John Knox, on the other hand, his understanding of the times will be significantly different. For Knox, the times in which he lives are times of idolatry. And they're times when it is the task of the churchman to speak out against the idolatry of the culture in which he lives. So if you were to say to Martin Luther, if you had Luther and Knox here today, and we would say to Luther, where do you see yourself most obviously fitting into the Bible? Which figure do you think you most resonate with? He would probably say one of the witnesses in Revelation. One of those witnessing right at the end of time. If you asked John Knox, without a shadow of a doubt, he would have said Elijah. He would look back to the Old Testament as providing him his understanding of the times. So hold that in your mind as we reflect upon the life of Knox then. I say we're not quite sure when he was born, nor are we sure where he went to university. He either went to the University of St. Andrews, or he went to the University of Glasgow. He certainly didn't go to my own alma mater, the University of Aberdeen. Aberdeen would be, I think, the very antithesis of Florida. Everything's built out of granite, it rains all the time, and during the winter, if the clouds don't clear, the streetlights stay on all day. It's a very dark and dingy place. I loved it. My wife, she's a Scot, she comes from even further north. She was not so keen on it, but I love the dark winters. I'm sort of antisocial. Nobody ever comes to visit you when it's dark, so I was very, very happy just to sit in my house all by myself. Knox was ordained as a Catholic priest, probably around about 1536. And he's certainly still a priest by the time we get to the early 1540s. We're not sure when he converts to Protestantism, but hold that in your mind. If Knox is still a Catholic priest in 1543, Luther dies in 1546. So you can see how the Reformation has really been underway for quite a while before Knox gets on board with Protestantism. And there are two figures that have an influence on Knox, two figures that he's associated with in the 1540s that bring him to Protestant convictions. The first is a man called Patrick Hamilton, who was a Lutheran preacher in Scotland and who will be martyred for his faith. And the second is a character called George Wishart. Wishart was a man who actually employed John Knox. Wishart was a Zwinglian preacher. He was a follower of the Zurich theologian and reformer Huldrych Zwingli, died in 1531. Wishart was a Zwinglian preacher in Scotland, travelled throughout Scotland preaching in favour of the Reformation in the 1540s. Very controversial thing, because Scotland not only had a strong Catholic church under a man called Cardinal Beaton, but the Scottish throne was also in the hands essentially of the French. A lady called Mary of Guise, the mother of Mary, Queen of Scots, was effectively in charge of Scotland in the 1540s. And an alliance of the French, of course, requires an alliance with Catholicism. This is the 16th century. You can't have a political alliance without some kind of theological agreement. So for Wishart to be preaching Protestantism in the 1540s would have been seen as treason by the crown. And so, sure enough, Wishart will soon find himself coming to the attention of the authorities. And he hires himself a bodyguard. And the bodyguard is John Knox. And there are some 19th century paintings, somewhat romanticized, showing Wishart preaching with a bearded man carrying what we call a claymore. If you've ever seen a claymore sword, it's a big two-handed sword. If you've seen, the film Rob Roy, somebody gets chopped in two. It's rather revolting. Somebody gets chopped in two with a claymore in the film Rob Roy. Very heavy sword. Probably be almost as tall as I am now. You have to handle it with two hands. And it's not a sword for doing sort of fencing with. It's a slashing weapon. You don't chop with it either because, you know, it's rather distasteful to say it, but if you chopped somebody with a claymore, the blade would get stuck and you wouldn't be able to pull it out and then somebody would kill you. So it's a slashing weapon, but it's a man's weapon. You've got to be a tough guy to wield this thing. And John Knox is the man who's hired to be the sword bearer for George Wishart. However, 1546, Wishart is arrested and prosecuted by Cardinal Beaton. And on the 1st of March 1546, he is burned at the stake. Knox, at this point, goes on the run. Cardinal Beaton is based in St. Andrews. If ever you've been to Scotland, I know this is a golfing community, probably you've been to St. Andrews. It's quite a remote town in the sort of south and east of Scotland, on something of a promontory going out into the sea. Cardinal Beaton was based in St. Andrews. And on the night of the 29th of May, 1546, a group of Scottish noblemen break into the castle in St. Andrews and put Cardinal Beaton to the sword. They break into his bedroom and they hack him to pieces in vengeance for George Wishart's execution. The assassins seize the castle and invite their friends and family to come and join them. John Knox at this time has become a tutor to some families, the Douglas and the Coburn families, and the families suggest that with all of the turmoil in Scotland as a result of this rebellion and the murder of the cardinal, that Knox should take their sons to the castle for safekeeping. And so Knox arrives at the castle, 10th of April, 1547, and is fairly quickly proposed to the congregation, to the group within the castle, by a man called John Rough, as the minister or pastor of the congregation. Knox tells us he was not very keen on the idea, he resisted it. I'm always very sceptical of that. John Calvin, of course, does the same. Apparently when he goes to Geneva the first time, he's forced under threat to stay and become a minister. They kick him out, he goes back a second time, and the second time he goes back, he doesn't want to become a minister. Well, when you learn the terms of the deal that John Calvin got the second time back in Geneva, his protestations of not wanting to be a minister become somewhat less compelling. He got double the salary of any other minister in Geneva. He got a free house. He was given a house. And he had hundreds of bottles of free wine given to him every year. It's when Calvin says, you know, I would rather die 1,000 deaths on a cross than go back to Geneva. I think it's hyperbole. From the early church onwards, it is standard practice for successful ministers, when they write their autobiographies, to tell you they never wanted the job in the first place. Gregory Nazianzus did it, John Calvin did it, Martin Buter does it, John Knox does it. Never wanted this job in the first place, even though he does it rather well. Those of you who've been to St. Andrews know the castle is out on a promontory. It's very, very difficult to take by land. That's one of the reasons why St. Andrews is a good place to hold yourself up, because you've got to get out to it on land. It's easy to defend. Mary of Guise, effectively the Queen Regent of Scotland at this point, knows that. So she summons her allies in the French Navy, and the French Navy storm the castle in June 1547. And the Protestant rebels within the castle, including John Knox, are taken into captivity and made into galley slaves. Now, most of us, I'm guessing, our impressions of what it's like to be a galley slave, you know, we go back to the old Charlton Heston film, Ben-Hur, when you've got all these sort of ripped and healthy guys sort of rowing, and you've got that man beating the drum, and he goes faster and faster, and they're able to race. And it looks like the sort of place where, you know, He-Man and Superman hang out. Galleys in the 16th century were hell on earth. We have records from the Inquisition of individuals confessing to more serious crimes than that with which they'd been accused in order to avoid being sent to the galleys. They preferred execution to being imprisoned on a galley. So Knox is sent to the galleys, and he will spend 19 months as a galley slave and survive. And I think that tells you a lot about this man, that a man can go to the galleys in the 16th century and survive 19 months tells you something about his physical and mental strength. Years later, Knox writes a history of the Reformation in Scotland, and he talks about his time on the galleys. He writes in the third person. He never identifies this man, but it has to be himself that he's talking about. He talks about a practice that the French galley masters had of bringing down an image of the Virgin Mary and making the Scottish Protestants kiss this image. It's just about the most offensive thing that could be done to a Scottish Protestant. And Knox recounts one incident where he says it was thrust into the hands of a Scotchman who, looking advisedly about him, threw the image overboard and said, "If our Lady is so wonderful, let her swim for herself." And then he has this laconic line, "And afterwards was no Scotsman urged with that idolatry." Shows you the you know, even in the galleys, he clearly had the kind of personality that the galley masters knew he was not somebody to mess with. And you also have that great insight there in here in Knox's experience in the galley. His later preoccupation with the notion of idolatry is being fixed in his mind at this point. All those years later, when he looks back at his time in the galleys, what is it he remembers? It's being given this image to kiss while he is there. February 1549, Knox's health is declining. But mysteriously, he is released from the galleys into the custody of the English at this point. And it appears what was going on, there was probably some kind of prisoner exchange. We all know, you know, during the Cold War, and it probably happens today, if you've seen the film version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, it happens there. This idea that in times of war or Cold War, there's always these sort of backroom deals being done between enemies so they can get the people they want back from captivity. It seems that something like that happened with John Knox, because there have been very interesting developments in England at this point. 1547, Henry VIII, man of many wives, dies. And his nine-year-old son, Edward VI, succeeds to the throne. And Edward is the ward of Protestant nobility. So England really goes Protestant at this point. England got rid of the Pope years ago, but retained Catholicism. Got rid of the Pope because the king needed a divorce. But it retained the theology of Catholicism. 1547, a young king, a young boy king, comes to the throne, and his advisors are Protestants, and England goes Protestant. And clearly the reputation of Knox has gone before him, to the point where the English think that this fiery Scotsman may be of use to them, in the English Reformation. Think about it as well from the point of view of Knox's imagination. Imagine you're released from the galleys into the hands of the English, and the English are engaging in Reformation under the watchful eye of a boy king. He's aged 11 at this point. Where does that take you? Where does your mind go when you think about that? Josiah. You can see how Knox's own biography would reinforce this growing sense of Old Testament destiny in his mind. So Knox is released into the hands of the English. And just to go back to the Josiah thing for a second, we have Bibles, typically public Bibles published in England during Edward's time and after, would typically portray King Josiah in their woodcuts as looking very like Edward. The English were very aware of the sort of recapitulation, if you like, of Edward, of Josiah in Edward. Knox is released into the hands of the English. And they now have an advantage or an opportunity, and they have a problem. The opportunity they have is they've got this very fiery Scotsman in their hands. And they can use him to push the Reformation. Archbishop Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, needs men like Knox that he can rely on to push the Reformation forward. The problem they've got, of course, is John Knox. John Knox is a man who's very headstrong, has his own opinions, and isn't going to be a team player. So what they do is they send him to Berwick-on-Tweed. You know, English geography. Berwick-on-Tweed is about as far north in England as you can go without being in Scotland. It's a brilliant move. It's a brilliant move for numerous reasons. One, when the Reformation comes to town, you've got to remember it's a little bit like 1989 in Europe, where when the Iron Curtain falls, yes, the men at the top are toppled, but the middle-ranking bureaucracy stay in place. It has to be that way. It's a total chaos. So when the Reformation comes to town in the 16th century, quite often the men at the top fall, but the rest of the clergy just fall into line, essentially, with whatever is the policy coming from London or whatever the capital city happens to be. The further north you go, therefore, from London, the more scope you have for the clergy in place to remain pretty much as they were before the Reformation arrived. Send the fiery Scotsman north, and you make life very difficult for the Catholic clergy who want to stay in situ during the time of the Reformation. Secondly, it's quite close to Scotland. So you encourage Scots to come over the border. And you destabilise the border a bit and make it difficult for the Scots. And thirdly, you send John Knox a long way away from London. So he can't make trouble for you where you're based. Knox, in Berwick-on-Tweed, will be obliged to use the recently released Book of Common Prayer. Book of Common Prayer, 1549, is a semi-Protestant, semi-Catholic document. The reason, of course, is although the Reformation is moving forward in England, everything has to be approved by Parliament, and Parliament is dominated by the Catholic nobility. So the Church has to make sure that whatever they present to the Parliament can get passed. You're very lucky in that the Catholic nobility have made a lot of money out of buying up church lands. So they're not over keen on seeing Catholicism come back, but they're not over keen on seeing Protestantism arrive either. So you've got to push very, very gently. Knox looks at the Book of Common Prayer and he sees that there are all kinds of problems with this. And he modifies it to make it more Protestant in the way while he's up in Berwick-on-Tweed. Also meets the lady who will become his first wife, a lady called Marjorie Bowes. He will have something of an itinerant preaching ministry up there, and he will debate the Bishop of Durham. Bishop of Durham was a man called Cuthbert Tunstall, a very educated man, friend of the great intellectual Desiderius Erasmus. Tunstall was Bishop of Durham at this point. And Knox debated him on the Mass. Mass, as you know, is the central point of medieval Catholic worship. And if you go to a Catholic cathedral today, certainly if you go to a medieval cathedral in Europe, you'll see this. Probably if you go somewhere like St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, you'll see it. You walk through the door and your eyes are drawn straight down towards the altar, because the architect has built the church building to reflect the priorities of the theology of the day. The Mass was and is the central act of Catholic piety. That is the moment that Christ, if you like, comes down to earth each time the Mass is celebrated. That is the moment when Catholic believers receive the grace of God. To Knox, this was idolatry. The worship of bread and wine, as he saw it, was idolatry. And he debated the Bishop of Durham and he laid out two syllogisms. Any form of worship not prescribed in Scripture is idolatry. The Mass is not prescribed in Scripture, therefore the Mass is idolatry. And the second syllogism, any act of Christian worship to which a wicked opinion is attached is an act of idolatry. There is a wicked opinion attached to the Mass, therefore the Mass is idolatry. You can see how Knox's mind is working. For him, idolatry is going to come to be identified with not only anything that the Bible doesn't forbid, but with anything that the Bible doesn't command. And that will make a big difference between Lutheran churches and Reformed churches. If you were on the continent, for example, and you went to Wittenberg, Luther's headquarters, and you walk into the castle chapel there, you'll be struck by the beauty of the stained glass windows and the gilt and the ornate architecture and the pictures and the crucifixes all around. And it will look very much like a Catholic cathedral to you. If you go to Zwingli's church in Zurich, the great minster in Zurich, it will be very bare and spartan. It has a beauty, but it's a very austere beauty. And the reason for that is theological. For Luther, if it wasn't forbidden in Scripture, it was permissible. And if having a stained glass window or a crucifix to help people to think about Christ, that was a good thing. For Zwingli, for the Reformed, for Knox, if it was not commanded in Scripture, then it was idolatrous to do it. This, of course, will flow over into Knox's understanding of the Book of Common Prayer. If ever you've been to an Anglican service, many Anglican communion services, one has to kneel to receive the elements at communion. And certainly when the second Book of Common Prayer is produced in 1552, kneeling is prescribed as a practice. Knox has moved south by this point. He's come back to London. He's been appointed a court preacher. And he gets to hear about this new Book of Common Prayer. And he reads it and he sees that kneeling is prescribed at communion. And he preaches before the boy king a sermon going after this as idolatry. One of the, it's always speculative when you think about the psychology of what's going on. But Edward VI was a young man. And generally speaking, I think young guys like edgy people. And they don't come much more edgy than Knox in the Reformation. And Knox's selection as a court preacher was undoubtedly influenced by Edward VI liking a radical. Young guys don't like moderate people. They want to hear something radical, iconoclastic. That was Knox. And when Edward hears of this, he gets very annoyed and he calls the Archbishop of Canterbury and says to him, why have we retained this idolatrous practice within the second Book of Common Prayer? Archbishop of Canterbury now faced with a bit of a dilemma. If he accedes to Knox's demands that it be removed, then it appears that he's no longer in control of the Church of England. But on the other hand, he's got to do something to placate the king. So what happens is that even after this book has been printed and it's lying in the printer's warehouse waiting for distribution, the black rubric is stuck in the front cover, glued in the front cover. What is the black rubric? Well, black makes it sound, you know, is it sinister? Is it scary? Is it threatening? No. If you have an old copy of the Book of Common Prayer, you'll know that the rubrics, the instructions that tell you why you're doing things, they're all printed in red. But in this edition of the Book of Common Prayer, the black rubric is printed in black, stuck in the front. It saved Cranmer's face because he was able to keep his liturgy as he wanted it. And it sort of grudgingly satisfied Knox that this rubric was clarifying. It actually stated that there was no worship of the elements implied in what was going on. 1553, things start a really nosedive. Edward VI is dying of tuberculosis at this point. He has no issue. And his sister, his older sister, Mary, is the heir apparent. She will inherit the throne if Edward dies. And her mother, of course, with Catherine of Aragon. Catherine of Aragon was Henry VIII's first wife. She was the woman who had all of these multiple miscarriages, couldn't produce a male heir for Henry, and so he divorced her. And as far as Mary is concerned, Protestantism destroyed her mother and has destroyed the kingdom. So it's very clear that if and when Edward dies, Protestantism will be swept out. Edward does die, and a desperate attempt is made to sort of instigate a Protestant coup. A young lady called Lady Jane Grey is crowned queen. Fatal mistake is made by the Protestants, though. They allow Princess Mary to escape from the capital. What they should have done, if I'd been in charge, what I'd like to think I would have done is had her captured and executed straight away. Sounds terribly heartless, but these are tough times. And, as the mafia would say, it's only business, it's not personal. But she heads to Norfolk and rallies the Catholic troops and brings them back to London. And what's interesting about the Catholic march on London is it is greeted with rejoicing in the streets. And it's I'm not here to speak about the English Reformation, but it is a reminder that the early years of Protestantism under Edward VI and the latter years of Henry VIII, to ordinary people, it just looked like corruption. A lot of people were making a lot of money out of it. It was corruption. It was marked by friends, appointing friends to high-ranking positions. If you want to know why the English Reformation succeeds, the English Reformation succeeds because Queen Mary instigates brutal execution of Protestants and actually allows the Protestants to appear as if they've got some integrity. Because under Edward, by and large, the Protestants looked corrupt. And that's why Mary coming to the throne and sweeping the Protestants from power in 1553 was greeted with rejoicing in the nation, not with sadness. We need to be careful that we don't superimpose our own preconceptions on what was going on when we look back. Knox had been offered a bishopric. Would he be a Bishop of Rochester, he'd been asked, under this new Lady Jane Grey regime. Wisely, Knox refuses it and instead heads to London, heads to the continent, arriving there in January 1554. Heads straight to Geneva, where in Geneva he meets Calvin and asks him a series of questions that indicate that his mind is already starting to think politically at this point. He asks whether a minor can rule by divine right, whether somebody beneath the age of responsibility can rule by divine right. That's obviously he's thinking about Edward there. Whether a female can rule and transfer sovereignty to her husband. Mary's on the throne. Mary is engaged to Philip II of Spain. The great fear of Knox, of course, is that English sovereignty will be passed to Spain, the House of Habsburg, will therefore be brought under the power of the Catholic Holy Roman Empire. Whether people should obey ungodly or idolatrous rulers, and what party godly persons should follow if they resisted an idolatrous ruler. Calvin gives very cautious replies to these questions. The whole notion of rebellion, which is so easy for us now, is very difficult for the 16th century. The idea that one would rebel against what was seen as the natural hierarchy was a very difficult concept to grasp in the 16th century. Knox is in Geneva for some months, and then in September 1554, he's invited to become the minister of the Congregation of English Exiles in Frankfurt. 16th century, like the 20th century. There may be the two centuries in Europe's history which were the centuries of exile, when there were so many displaced people. In the 20th century, of course, it was done along ethnic grounds. There was constant ethnic cleansing and ethnic displacement. In the 16th century, it's done along religious or confessional grounds. When the monarch swings Catholic, the Protestant intellectuals have to move on. Same way when the monarch goes Protestant, Catholic intellectuals have to move on. So there were churches all over Europe. There were enclaves of exiles needing to be pastored by somebody who spoke their native language and knew their context. Knox is invited to become the pastor of the Church of the Exiles in Frankfurt, and he does, and is there for some months until he is driven out by a faction rallying around the Book of Common Prayer. Knox arrives there, they're using the Book of Common Prayer. Knox gets rid of that, writes his own liturgy. Another faction arrive, or a hardcore Book of Common Prayer people. And you have these rather bizarre services where one part of the church would be using Knox's liturgy, and simultaneously, the other part of the church would be using the Book of Common Prayer, leading to chaos. I always have fun. Well, as dean, I had to go to various Association of Theological Schools meetings, and they would always have these worship services in the morning, and they would be done by one of the representative seminaries there, and sometimes they were very liberal seminary would do the worship service, and friends of mine would not go because they would say it's all blasphemous. I would go because I say, well, it'll give me something to write about. And I would always in those mornings try to make sure that I sat next to the table where I could, the most radical feminists were sitting, because they would always use inclusive language. When the Missouri Synod Lutherans were doing the liturgy, it would always be in exclusive language, and the feminists would always shout out inclusive language, and it would be total chaos, but quite amusing if you were sitting and watching the whole thing go down. Must have been like that for Knox in Frankfurt, except, of course, it costs him his job. Knox, he reveals himself something as a man of principle here, because this new faction that have come in apply for church membership. And Knox allows them to become members of the church, knowing that they will immediately vote to dismiss him as pastor. You know, he's a classic, I'm a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. To me, he's a classic Orthodox Presbyterian at this point. He would rather follow the rules and see himself sort of shot through the back of the head than play fast and loose with the rules in order to win. Knox brings this dissident faction in as members because they profess faith in Christ, and immediately they convene a members' meeting and have him dismissed as pastor. He then also has to flee Frankfurt because he referred, apparently in a sermon, to the Emperor Charles V as Nero. If you know your ancient Roman history, Nero is not the best emperor to be likened to on the whole, and the emperor took it really rather bad. Returns to Geneva, and again is the minister of the Church of the Genevan, of the English exiles there, makes a short trip back to Scotland to see what is going on there. And in Scotland you have a situation where in England the Reformation is driven by the crown, the king wanted Reformation. The nobility sort of stood in his way but couldn't stop it ultimately. In Scotland, you have the opposite situation. The crown don't want Reformation. The crown are French. They're allied to the French. It's the middle-ranking nobility who want the Reformation because they see an alliance with England as a way of throwing off the yoke of France. So Knox's observations are that there is great tension emerging in the political hierarchy in Scotland between the nobility, who lean in a Protestant direction, because that allows them to pursue a foreign policy relative to England, and the crown, Mary of Guise and her young daughter Mary, Queen of Scots, who are pursuing a pro-French Catholic policy. Returns to Geneva and lives there a happy life, pastoring the church, possibly the happiest years of his life. And he says this about Geneva: "I neither fear nor shame to say it is the most perfect school of Christ that ever was in the earth since the days of the apostles. In other places I confess Christ to be truly preached, but manners and religion so sincerely reformed I have not yet seen in any other place." His life in Geneva would have been one of a fairly constant round of preaching. He'd have preached probably three times a week. Typically sermons in the 16th century lasted for over 2 hours. That's pretty brutal when you think about it. That's a long time. And when you remember that in the 16th century, probably people would have stood. You know, you'd have brought your own stool, or you'd have stood for 2 hours of preaching. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff. On the other hand, remember, of course, that sermons were a bit like entertainment. You didn't just go to church in order to hear the word expounded. It's where you got your information about the world. Likelihood is you couldn't read, so you depended upon somebody telling you what was going on. And if you look at 16th century sermons, they're full of information about what's going on in the world. So a sermon in the 16th century was a sort of combination of biblical exposition, newscast and political commentary, all rolled into one. So a 2-hour sermon would probably have been heavy duty, but may not have been as heavy as it would be today. He also publishes at this time his most famous book, or infamous book. It was the first of a three-parter. He never wrote the second two parts. The title was The First Blast of the Trumpet, against the monstrous regiment of women. The title itself needs a bit of translating. Monstrous means strange or out of the ordinary. I remember when I was teaching on this in Aberdeen once, and a lady in the class put her hands up and said, "Monstrous regiment, how many of them were there?" Well, I'd say there were two or three. Monstrous means strange, and regiment means rule. It doesn't mean like an army division or something. The strange rule of women. This is Knox's argument that women should not hold political office. It's completely bonkers. I mean, you read it. It's a nutty piece of work. But what's interesting about it, of course, is that every woman in power that Knox had ever come across had tried to have him burned at the stake. I do think before we condemn him too much, that would no doubt have shaped his opinion of women. It's a disaster. This is an unmitigated disaster for the Protestants on the continent. Because 1558 is the year that Elizabeth I comes to the throne in England. And she is the great white hope of Protestantism in Europe at this point. The emperor has really pushed back Protestantism in the 1540s and 1550s on the continent. England and Scotland will very soon be the sort of strongest last bastion holdouts for Protestantism. And Knox has just written something that calls into question the legitimacy and the intellectual competence of women holding office. It causes such diplomatic disaster in Geneva. There is a letter in the Genevan archives from Calvin to Knox's publisher saying, "Do not publish anything else by this man because I cannot vouch for its orthodoxy." It caused a major diplomatic disaster among the Protestant network in Europe at the time. And it earned Knox a life ban from England. He was banned from ever having safe conduct through England again. My wife is a Scot. I always love to tell her, John Knox, he was deeply saddened by that because he always said that England had been one of the happiest places that he'd ever lived. He much preferred it to Scotland, I believe. My wife doesn't particularly like to hear that. So Knox then returns, though, in 1559 to Scotland. And there he will quickly ally himself with the powerful emerging faction of Protestant nobles. He will preach a vigorous sermon to a group of Protestants summoned to Stirling by the Queen Regent, Mary of Guise. There will be a riot there that Knox will effectively stir up. And over the next few years, the Reformation will press forward in Scotland. Knox will, in 1560, present to the Scottish Parliament a confession, the Scots Confession of 1560, and the Book of Discipline, the first Book of Discipline. The Scots Confession, if there had not been the Westminster Assembly in the 17th century, the Scots Confession would have been the Presbyterian Confession of the Presbyterian churches. It is only superseded by the Westminster Confession in the 17th century. It is written by six men, all with the first name John. They're known as the Six Johns. But the most powerful and guiding hand behind them was undoubtedly John Knox. It's an interesting confession among other things. It has discipline. It lists discipline as a mark of the church, which Calvin never did. Calvin never had discipline as a mark of the church. Not sure why. He never got the discipline he wanted in Geneva. So it may have been that he didn't want to define his own church out of legitimacy. Or it could have been that discipline was such a hallmark of the Anabaptists, Calvin wanted to avoid looking like an Anabaptist. Or it could be a combination of the two. They're not mutually exclusive. The Scots Confession has discipline as one of the marks of the church. And certainly Scotland will provide fascinating examples of church discipline in the next century. I'll talk about those in just a minute. The second interesting aspect of the Scots Confession is its treating of predestination. It's entirely focused on Christ. The Scots Confession really doesn't talk about a double decree or about election and reprobation. in the way that, say, the Westminster Confession will do. When it talks about election, it talks about the election of Christ. And it's a fascinating gap. Knox does write a great long treatise on predestination, but it comes just after he's fallen out with Calvin over the trumpet blast against women. And it would seem that he possibly wrote this, Treatise on Predestination, as a way of sort of ingratiating himself with Calvin. He himself does not appear to have had much of an interest in the doctrine otherwise. Church discipline, just as an aside, we get some of our most fascinating insights into church discipline in the Reformation from the Scots, because they kept excellent church records from the middle of the 16th century onwards. Presbyterian churches in Scotland keep excellent records. And one of the things that is most fascinating about these records is it becomes very clear when you look at what ordinary churches were dealing with, that it's not what you'd expect. One of the problems we always have as historians of the early modern period is, what did ordinary people think? Most of them couldn't read or write. So how do you get access to how ordinary people behaved? It's very difficult. But if you look at Scottish church discipline records, you can see how they misbehaved. And that gives you an insight into how they thought about the Reformation. And what's interesting about Scottish church records of the 16th, 17th century is most people were not being disciplined for running off and having a mass with the local priest. Most people were being disciplined for doing things like casting spells to make the milkmaid fall in love with them. It's very interesting that we think about the Reformation very much as a top-down, confessional, intellectual thing. At a grassroots level, chances are, if you were a parish minister, you would not be having to argue the metaphysics of the Mass with your congregation. You'd be having to persuade them, you know, white witchcraft really doesn't work. Folk religion was the enemy in the 16th century of the church at a grassroots level. The first book of discipline is also fascinating as well. It never gets official sanction within the church, but among other things, it proposes the establishment of schools in every parish in order to fuel literacy. Reformation is above all a word-centered movement, and that was reflected in the educational policy of the church. You needed schools to teach people to read so they could read the Bible for themselves. Knox's wife, Marjorie, sadly dies in 1560. A few years later, he will marry another lady, causes a right old scandal, the second marriage. She's 17. It's, you know, slightly unwholesome to have this really, by 16th century standards, very old man marrying a 17-year-old girl, but they seem to have got on well. The marriage seems to have been happy, and they had three children. Mary of Guise also dies, and the crown passes to Mary, Queen of Scots. I don't know if my wife loves Hallmark Hall of Fame channel, is that what it's called on the television? And they always have these sort of romantic thriller kind of things on. And one that pops up with remarkable regularity, it seems, is the story of Lady Jane Grey. Helena Bonham Carter plays her. Can't be an entirely bad film if Helena Bonham Carter is playing the lead. But you'll remember that... I'm giving you an anecdote about an earlier queen. I'm talking here about Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary, Queen of Scots, when she's portrayed on the... Is it Margaret Lockwood who plays her? I can't remember. Anyway, the typical cultural portrayal of Mary, Queen of Scots is she's like one of those china dolls that if you touch, a little piece will break off. And she has this horrible thug, John Knox, coming and berating her on numerous occasions and terrifying her. And he was a real bully and a thug. Mary, Queen of Scots, was not like that. Mary, Queen of Scots, had been brought up in the Scottish and French courts. She was very well aware of how politics operates. She was very ruthless. Her first husband, Lord Darnley, had her lover, David Rizzio, murdered. So Mary, Queen of Scots, hits back by having her husband blown up. She has him blown up. She was very capable of looking after herself. And it's important to hold that in mind, because she will have a series of confrontations with Knox. You've got this problem, you see. You have the Queen, the Crown is a Catholic. The nobles are Protestant. Parliament is legislating Protestantism. But the Queen continues to celebrate Mass. And this is where John Knox's Old Testament sensibility comes in. You know your Old Testament. You know that you think about King David. When King David sins, when he sleeps with Bathsheba, his reign is never the same again. The whole nation suffers when David sins. Remember, he has the people numbered, and the Lord, you know, sends the plague, and the plague ravages. That's how Knox thought about 16th century Scotland. When the Queen celebrates Mass in her private chapel, it's not a private chapel at all for Knox. The nation goes and commits idolatry. The nation takes Mass in the person of the Queen. And Knox will have a series of encounters when he will clash with Mary in order to try to convince her that she must not engage in Catholic practices, because in doing so, she brings the nation into an idolatrous situation. Mentioned that she has her husband murdered in 1566. And this will precipitate civil war, effectively, in Scotland. It will culminate in Mary fleeing to England to seek refuge at the court of her cousin, Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth will have Mary put under house arrest and will ultimately have her executed, because she becomes a focal point for Catholic plots in England against the crown. Knox becomes the chief religious spokesman for the civil war, for the rebellion in Scotland. Marries, as I say, this much younger lady. And then in November 1572, he will be taken ill. 24th of November 1572, his young wife reads a passage of scripture to him, and he dies. It is probable that some of the last news he would have heard would have been the massacre of Protestants in St. Bartholomew's Day in 1572 in France. Ostensibly a wedding feast for a royal marriage in Paris, became an excuse for massacring Protestants. August the 31st, 1572. A couple of months before Knox dies, but news travels comparatively slowly in those days. He was survived by his five children. He's buried, if you go to Edinburgh, you go to St. Giles Cathedral, there is a car park, or parking lot, as you would say, behind the cathedral. If you look along the rows of car park spaces, one of them has a small marble square in it. There's no wording or writing on it at all. John Knox is buried beneath that car park space, St. Giles, as Calvin, he wished to be buried in an anonymous grave. We know where it is, but there is nothing to mark it. Knox's reputation since his death, in some way it would be an interesting study to look at how Knox's reputation has changed over the years. It's even happened in my own lifetime. I lived in Scotland for significant chunks of my adult life, and Knox's reputation changed even then. He was at one point a champion of no popery, anti-Catholicism in the 19th century, when Irish immigration dramatically fueled the fear of Catholicism, which was seen as a sort of alien political plot at that point. So Knox was a hero then. There were statues of him put up. Then, of course, he became the great whipping boy for feminists because of his writing against women in authority. And, of course, his strong stand against Catholicism became somewhat less acceptable in 20th century society. So when I first went to Scotland in the late 80s, Knox was not a highly thought of figure. But then in the 1990s, there was this resurgence of Scottish nationalism. And what's interesting is that Knox suddenly becomes the champion of democracy and the champion of Scottish national identity. The problem, of course, with going back into the past and grabbing hold of a figure like Knox is, Knox was not really the champion of democracy. Knox was champion of the triumph of Presbyterian Protestantism. There is no doubt that were one to be a Baptist in Scotland, Knox would have wanted you put in prison. So he's certainly not a champion of democracy as we would understand it in the 21st century. Nor was he particularly a champion of Scottish national identity. He regarded Geneva as the great boilerplate for society, and he was happier in England than he was in Scotland. So Knox is one of these figures who's, I think over the years, that the Scots have been able to project onto him whatever their particular preoccupations of the time have been. Of course, we're all vulnerable to doing that. So Knox then, an interesting figure. Of all of the reformers, probably the most, probably the least pragmatic and most outspoken, and certainly in terms of his life story, the most self-consciously, violently iconoclastic in his rhetoric and in his policies. Got a few minutes left now. I will throw it open for any questions you might like to ask. You won't want to probe me. I think